right now somewhat closer to home, but still a metropolitan man. Writer Colin Fleming checks in with us from Greater Boston. Hello, Mr. Fleming.
How's it going, Mr. Gimbel?
I'm getting by. I'm doing what I can to keep my head above water, waiting for that spring weather to arrive. We got a little tease this weekend, but it's been a bit raw the last couple of days.
Yeah, good for you. Built character.
I say that often as I'm bundled up walking the dog, who seems oblivious to all of those things, nose down, focused on the task at hand.
As are you.
Occasionally, yes. Yes, indeed. A lot of things going on in sports right now. In the Stanley Cup playoffs, very interesting development. What is going on with the Tampa Bay Lightning?
Yeah, I was about to ask you about that. Do you think, the game must be tonight, right? Do you think the Lightning are going to be swept out of the playoffs? I think at this point you have to say, can they, it's kind of like off the table that they could even come back, right? We'd be talking history. We'd be talking ruined flyers. We'd be talking the Islanders, right? We'd be going back to like the 1940s other than that. Although I think coming back from 3-0, it happened a few years ago too, the Kings did it. I think it's overrated in hockey in a sense. It's more doable in hockey, but from what I've seen of that series, the Lightning look very tight. They look nervous, although I'm thinking if they were to right the ship right now, going to be a problem. They're going to be a problem team for everyone else. So they're on the ground, snap the neck, end that, throw them in the backyard fire, let's move on.
Well, and one would think that might be a nice opening for the Bruins, but the way they're playing, I'm not sure they'll survive their opening series.
Me neither. I kind of thought this year that the Leafs were due. They're that young team, up and coming, then they added Tavares and think, okay, veteran presence. He's a little bit overrated, but he's a top, like, 15 to 18 guy in the league, older guy compared to some of the other players they have, like Austin Matthews. And they just seem due, the Leafs in general, and then specifically with the Bruins. But you think, okay, the Bruins play their game, and Tuukka Rask isn't horrible. Or if he is, he's taken out pretty quickly, which Cassidy would seem to favor. And their top line plays like their top line. Krejci has been good secondary scoring this year, and I think he's even been better defensively than he has been offensively. That's a part of his game that is underreported. And if Charlie McAvoy could play like a legitimate top-pairing 1A defenseman, I figured they would be okay in the series in five or six games. But from what I did see last night, the line of Marchand, Bergeron, and Pastrnak was just not in sync. That's a very interesting line because you have three guys who are potential Hall of Famers on that line, and two of the players on that line right now are better than the guy who is a definite Hall of Famer, who is playing, in the regular season at least, the best hockey of his career. Very weird, right, when you think about it. And yet they were very discombobulated, and there was no flow, and then that seemed to be a trickle-down effect for the rest of the team. So I don't know what to expect now.
Well, with that in mind, let's talk about some important, memorable, favorite playoff series, upset possibilities, and some teams of yours through the years. And do you want to start back with what happened in 1982, the New York Islanders team?
Sure, yes, with the Pittsburgh Penguins. That Islanders team was, you could say that they're akin to the 2004 New England Patriots in that any way you wish to play, they could beat you. All-time great teams even cannot usually say that. The Oilers, for instance, of a few years later had the run and gun. But the Islanders could play finesse hockey. They could out-tough you. They could out-check you, out-skate you. They could win by special teams. They had everything going on, and they had won a couple cups in a row, and they had their most dominant regular season in 81-82. Mike Bossy had 147 points. That was the best year he had, although he was still like 60-odd points behind Gretzky for the scoring lead. And they were playing the lowly Pittsburgh Penguins. This is the pre-Mario Lemieux Pittsburgh Penguins. And the Pittsburgh Penguins had the Islanders basically in last right stages. up 2 goals in the third. The Islanders somehow rallied to tie it. Billy Smith made an amazing save in overtime. And John Tinelli, a very underrated player, parted the key goal that sent them on their way, and they played an overmatched, a very overmatched Vancouver Canucks team that was only in the finals, basically, because the Oilers were beset with hubris. But it was one of those classic upsets that wasn't, which can be kind of as interesting as the upsets, I think, that were.
And one that did occur, 1970-71 season, a Bruins team coming off a Stanley Cup championship, heavily favored against a Montreal team that I think finished third in the regular season, but all went south for the Bruins.
It sure did. Now, that Bruins team in the early 1970s, Stan Fischler coined the term Big Bad Bruins. This is a misnomer with the early 70s teams. The early 70s Bruins were the greatest offensive team in hockey's history, and I am including the Gretzky, Curry, Messier, Anderson, Coffey Oilers. They had something like 7 of the top 10 leading scorers in the league. That's obscene. That's not right. That's like Carnegie Steel. Break up the monopoly. That's not how it's supposed to go. And I was reading a list the other day that this hockey history site put together. All of these people voted on it. And they had the top 100 players of all time. And a lot of people had Bobby Orr number one. And I think that Bruins team, considering how great Orr was, and you can make the argument that Phil Esposito is the most underrated player in NHL history, because I don't think he was a product of Orr. You could make the case that Bobby Orr is the most underachieving great player in the history of North American team sport. They only won the 2 championships. That Canadiens team had no business. Now, I know they had Ken Dryden as a pre-rookie, but we're talking someone who played college hockey, and then you're playing this Bruins team, and he stoned them. That's one of the great things, of course, about the NHL playoffs. You can have a goalie who just says, nah, sorry, fellas, not on my watch. You will be stoned. And that's exactly what happens. Now, normally, that runs out, that kind of play, and it's like the end of a Shakespeare play where natural order is restored. Who should win ends up winning. Didn't really go that way with Dryden, because when you have a goalie like that, you think it's going to be like a Steve Penny kind of deal. You don't think it's like this all-time goalie, and that's what Dryden was. And you had guys at the end of their career who were great Hall of Famers in Shaw and Bellevue, and yeah, the Bruins, just as they say, defecated the bed.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. What's another favorite upset or near upset of yours?
I love, and it might be my, it's up there for me, the 1982, same year as the Islanders. So everybody thought, Islanders, Oilers. This was when the Oilers had finally arrived. Gretzky had 92 goals that year. And he became this crossover celebrity that you didn't get with hockey. And the Oilers were just the most exciting up and down the ice type of team. Paul Coffey, you couldn't even really classify him as a defenseman. He was a rover, which you only know if you play like shinny on ponds in places like Bangor, Maine. And they were up on the lowly Los Angeles Kings. Now, if you're a hockey fan presently, but you don't really know the history, you might not be aware that you could be 25 games under 500. You could basically be a peewee squad, and you would make the playoffs, so long as you didn't finish last in your division, for the most part. This Kings team was abysmal. They were one of the worst teams ever to qualify for the playoffs. And the Oilers are in Game 3. They're up 5-0 in the third period. Video's on YouTube, and it's also on my blog. I put it up, too. And you see the Oilers coach, Glenn Sather, he's laughing on the bench. He's like, this is fun. This is great. Pretty great time here. And the Oilers are joking around. You have the best player ever in Wayne Gretzky. It's not even close. They're up 5-0 in the third period, and they lose the game. What are the mathematical, you know how you see that win probability when you watch right. something on TV, and it's like, their win probability is 93.4%. That's the only time you could have watched it and would have been like 108%. You would have been like, oh, yeah, of course, right? If you're playing squirt hockey, you're not going to come back from 5-0 if you drop a ringer in there in the final period. And the video of it is just one of the most joyous things. And for a long time, it was the highlight of the Kings' history because it was so rubbish. And you had Marcel Dion underachieving every year. And that didn't win them the series. You'd think the Oilers would have bounced back, but it went the full, it was just 5 games for that round. And the Kings won in Edmonton in Game 5 of all places. And it was just like disaster for Edmonton.
Let's get away from hockey for just a moment because of events in the news. You wrote a terrific piece on the Daily Beast about Notre Dame, the cathedral, and the fact that probably the most famous bit of literature associated with it was actually written to try and preserve the cathedral.
It was written, in a sense, with an eye on architectural preservation. Now, we have to remember that this was a 1,000-page book, and there was a lot going on in the book. And I think what Hugo did that was so interesting is he realized the relationship between architecture and prose. Prose is architecture. Prose is a lot of things. In fact, the least thing that prose is words. Prose is architecture, it's geometry, it's music, it's how shapes fit together. It's all of these different things. It's painting. And then somewhere in there are words. So he basically used this idea of the cathedral as a character, and he had the ancillary motivation of, hey, this is going to help out this structure that means a lot to me, that's meaning less and less to people as we go along in our late 1820s, early 1830s society, because he believed that to create something like that cathedral was akin to creating works of art that required concentration, that asked something of an audience that wasn't taxing in terms of their mental acuity, but it wasn't the same as looking at whatever the Twitter was of Hugo's day. And the thing about something like Notre Dame is, your eyeball has to do a little bit of work. It has to move around. Your eyes basically have to think, which I think is a really neat idea because we're so used to just glancing at something. We don't notice anything. I experienced this in the monument. I experienced this in the monument today as I'm climbing up and down at Bunker Hill. The number of people who say to me, even though I've passed them 18 times, keep going. You're almost there. You can do it. I'm thinking, like, are you sleeping, kidding me? Really? You're talking smack to me. You're not giving me my monument-based respect. And it's like, I could be the Thing from the comic book, and I could be running up and down, and they wouldn't even notice. And I think when we don't notice, when we don't think with our eyes, we think less and less with our brains, we devolve, and that is what Hugo was attempting to mitigate against, really. And at the same time, he wanted to bring awareness to this cathedral because he wanted to help it with its upkeep. There had been renovations to the cathedral, and in the novel, he writes them in saying, like, look, these are awful. You have these beautiful windows, and you put, like, these cotton ball-like boards over them, basically, now. It looks like some sickly patient. So that was part of his motivation.
Read Colin's work in this week's online on the dailybeast.com. And, of course, check out everything he's doing, is done, and will do in the future. It's all there on his blog and website at colinflemminglit.com. And we would never tell you to keep going if we see you at the monument, because we know that you've got about 5 more climbs to go at any given time we see you.
Kimball, I did 13 the other day for
good
a personal best.
Lord.
And as I did the last one, I screamed out your name. I said, Kimball! And everyone said, wow, that guy is intense. I said, you think I'm intense? You should try out Hard Rock and Rich Kimball up there in Bangor, Maine.
I live to motivate. That's my goal.
Yeah, I know.
Thanks, Colin.
See you.
See you next week. Colin Flemming every Tuesday on Downtown.